Hello, and welcome back to our latest Fraser Valander podcast. I'm Hannah Randolph, an economist here at the Institute, and here with me today are FAI Director Marius Voege and Deputy Director Joao Souza, and we're here to do a year in review. So what happened this year, guys?
Well, I don't know about you, but it's felt like a very long year. And when I was thinking back on what happened this year, I thought, was that this year? It feels like it was a long time ago. There's obviously been a lot of political changes in turn, both at Scotland's level and in Westminster over the course of this year. And from a political point of view, everybody's sort of thinking ahead to the election, we presume, at some point in 2024, although in theory it could be in January 2025. So when we think we're having a tough Christmas this year, with the budget being so close to Christmas, the Scottish budget, it'll be interesting to see what next Christmas is like if we're in the middle of a general election campaign. But just sort of taking a step back, you know, more broadly than just the work we do, just thinking about things that have happened this year, I've been struck by, the wider issues around forecasting growth in the economy over the course of 2023. Now, economic forecasting is a tricky business, and also what we see generally, if we look across all forecasters, both sort of those who are doing it for public finances, but also those who do it, you know, more broadly to inform commentary on the economy, they tend to bunch in packs. and people, you know, do tend to look at what other people are thinking and feed that into their thinking when they're doing forecasting. At the end of the day, economic forecasters are people too, and do take account of the wider environment and what other folk are saying. And it is the case that many forecasters thought that during 2023, at some point, we would be in a recession. So this time last year, that's certainly what we were thinking, that we would maybe have a short, what we would call a technical recession in Scotland. That is when the economy shrinks for two quarters in a row. And what we've seen is that hasn't happened. We have had a shrinkage in the economy in second quarter, but then there was growth in the third quarter. And the UK economy sort of bumped around zero as well, but hasn't fallen into that technical recession. But what we have seen is just really poor growth, just really anemic growth. So when we're asked, you know, what are the sort of bright spots in the economy, it's pretty hard sell to say, well, we weren't in a recession when we thought we would be, even though there's sort of no growth. But it does show the sort of difficulties of forecasting, because I suppose that the business space has proven more resilient in some ways. And having a look at the data, I would reflect that it's probably a little bit about the inequality of the impact of the cost of living crisis in our economy, where there are a lot of people who are struggling a lot. And you can see that, particularly on the retail side, that coming through in the data that we see on the retail sector. But there are also people who aren't struggling, and those who were able to save money during COVID, perhaps those who own their own home outright, so they're not being impacted by higher interest rates on mortgages, you know, this sort of thing, you know, do have money to spend and are spending money in the economy. So, you know, we are seeing the economy more resilient overall than was expected. But it still doesn't look like the prospects for, you know, growth are very good or very exciting for next year. And most forecasters think, you know, there will be growth next year, but it'll be pretty muted. So we'll no doubt come back next year and talk about why we were completely wrong again. and that perhaps we have had a recession during 2024. But it's unlikely to be a year of, you know, very buoyant growth.
I'm reminded of my first macroeconomics class, where the lecturer did the old joke of economists accurately predicting 9 out of the last 5 recessions. and we are in that business, aren't we? But it's just so hard to know exactly where you're going to land, which side of zero you're going to land. But essentially, as Mari said, it's just no growth or hardly any at all in the last 2 years.
And it links to another of my reflections on the year, actually, which is about the difficulty of precisely estimating what's going on in the economy. Now, as you guys know, I like to talk about economic statistics a lot and how we actually measure the economy.
We love it when you talk about economic statistics.
And any of our listeners who read our blogs regularly, our weekly update blogs, will see that we do like to talk about what the latest stats tell us. But we can't be too obsessed about the point estimates that come out, particularly at the very early estimates of what's happening in the economy. And one thing that's happened this year is both a bit fairly and a bit unfairly, the ONS have received quite a lot of bashing for the revisions that they've put through in the data for the recovery from the pandemic. And sometimes in the sort of economic statistics community, we talk about how to present these sorts of updates to data, because quite often it's the fact that early on you only have a limited set of data that you can use to say what the growth has been. And over time you get more and more information, get a fuller and fuller picture of actually what happened. So quite often you know how companies are doing in terms of their kind of turnover, but you don't necessarily know immediately what's happening in terms of the cost of their inputs. And those sorts of things do matter when you're actually trying to figure out what the value added in the economy is. So as we get more information, they are refined and updated. And perhaps it's more helpful to think about them as updates rather than revisions. So it's not that the data was wrong before, it's just that we've had more data that updates. And this is just a part of estimating the economy. It's just a part of economic statistics. And it doesn't mean that necessarily anything was done that's wrong, but perhaps there's a way to think about how we could communicate these changes better in the future. And linked to that, of course, we can't talk about economic statistics over the course of this year without reflecting on some of the issues that there have been in measuring the labour market. What we've seen since the autumn is that there's been difficulties in some of the data sets that are normally used to estimate what's going on in the labour market, which means whilst some figures for the UK as a whole have been produced based on various sources of information, we haven't had, for example, data for Scotland or any other of the parts of the UK since that period of time, which is obviously a bit of a worry. Hannah, I don't know if you want to say anything more about what you think's going on there for the ONS.
Yes, I think it's an interesting one. You know, they've had falling response rates and they've known about this for some time now, and so that's why they've been transitioning to this transformed labor force survey, and they've now moved up the launch of the TLFS, as it will be called, a little bit to meet some of these concerns. But it does really highlight how much we rely on those statistics. I would say, you know, the labor force survey maybe doesn't get as much press on a regular basis as it has now that we see that the sample sizes are not quite big enough to have accurate estimates of what's going on in the economy. But that is something that we rely on to do research, to make policy, and so I'm very interested to see what the transformed labor force survey brings in the spring.
Yeah, absolutely, because we can see it's not just about folk like us who are interested in what's going on in the sort of nations and regions of the UK. But, you know, it's important for the devolved governments, for example, to understand what's going on in their local economies. You know, they do have responsibilities for economic development and employability and all these things. So to not have that data, it is really problematic. And you can also see from some of the things that the Bank of England have said around their assessments of the economy every 6 weeks when they're making their interest rate decisions, that, you know, they are feeling that some of the data that's coming out of the ONS, you know, is giving them different signals from other data that they're gathering on the economy. So, you know, this really matters. It really impacts the sorts of decisions that the Bank of England, for example, are able to make, which in the end affects all of our lives. So it's really important that this data is robust and able to be relied upon.
Yeah. And the Bank of England, I mean, at the best of times, they rely on data that's ever so slightly out of date anyway, because, you know, you're making decisions now and it's going to affect things from now on, but, you know, the latest economic statistics are usually delayed by a month, maybe 2 months, depending on a particular time series. The fact that we now don't really have reliable or as reliable an estimate of what the unemployment and the employment rate, for example, are, that means that the Bank of England is kind of like flying blind. They don't know exactly what the state of the labor market is, and therefore it's really hard to know what should we do in terms of interest rates and where in the peak of the propagation of the monetary policy decisions that they have made already are we? Because it is quite a lagged process. It takes time for people's decisions to change. And if you don't know, not only do you not know now, but you're unlikely to know with much certainty in the future either, because there'll just be this bit of this particular shock that we'll have very little visibility over, because so the Transformed Labor Force survey will come online as a full survey in the spring, but they are already doing testing on it, but it's still being fine-tuned, so it won't necessarily be the estimates for this time of this year won't be as good necessarily. And also we don't know, because what they were planning on doing, I think, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, is to try and calibrate the results during the overlap period of the two surveys. But now we're in a situation where we can't rely on that overlap period anymore.
Yeah, I think the plan is to calibrate using other data, and they've brought in different experimental sources, but that's certainly something to look out for. So I was hoping that we could talk a little bit about a couple of things that the Fraser in particular have done this year. So could you guys share some of the highlights that we've had for our Fraser Wrapped, if you will?
Absolutely. Well, one thing I wanted to highlight was something that we do every single quarter to try and understand what's going on in the economy, and that's our Scottish Business Monitor. So we do that in partnership with the law firm Addleshaw Goddard, who help support the Business Monitor. And it's a survey of businesses that we do just to try and understand how businesses are feeling, how they're feeling sort of about the last period that's just gone, and how confident they're feeling about the future. And we also ask them some kind of topical questions to get their views on things. So in the spring, we had our 100th edition of the Scottish Business Monitor, and we released a special report which sort of looked at the sort of 25 years of the Business Monitor and what it's told us about the Scottish economy over that period of time. And it did show, I mean, we've done some analysis this year to show that, you know, it doesn't do bad at predicting, you know, where those turning points might be in the economy. And it does give a good indication of kind of what's coming. So that's quite reassuring that it does help us understand in a more kind of immediate way what's going on in the economy, much more than sort of backward looking statistics can. It does have its limitations, of course, because, you know, all of these feelings and the sort of sentiment and confidence don't always translate into what happens in the economy. But it's certainly an additional source of information which we find really useful. Some of the most interesting analysis that comes out of the Business Monitor, though, can often be about these topical questions that we ask. And there was an example of this over the summer, where in response to the fact the Scottish Government were launching their New Deal for Business, as they've called it, we wanted to get a baseline view from businesses in Scotland about how they felt about the Scottish Government. And the idea here was about how businesses feel about the Scottish Government introducing policies which might affect their business. So there's obviously the examples of things like the deposit return scheme, which was felt that was perhaps nobody disagreed with the kind of idea of it or the sentiment of it or the overall goals of it, but just perhaps the way it had been introduced and a lack of engagement with businesses meant that it wasn't going to be practical in the end. Now, we all know what happened with that in terms of the Internal Market Act and the intervention by the UK government, but it was just that's just an example of some of the regulations that have been introduced by the Scottish Government where it has been felt that there's been a lack of real understanding of the impact that this might have on the business community. So we asked businesses whether they felt that there was sort of effective engagement from the Scottish Government when the government were considering changes which might affect their business, and if they had a kind of route to influence, and whether the government actually just overall understands the business environment in Scotland. And the results weren't great for the Scottish Government. Only around 8% of businesses felt that the Scottish Government understands the business environment, and around 9% felt that the government engaged effectively when they were considering a change. And interestingly, for kind of business representative organisations, I think, there was only 19% of businesses felt that they had a route to influence, so they had somebody they could ask to kind of make the case for them, which again I think is quite interesting and might reflect the business base in Scotland a little bit, because it is vastly made up of, you know, very small micro businesses, the vast majority of it. So that was quite interesting. We published that over the summer, and what we're planning to do is to kind of redo that maybe in next summer, you know, and it'll be interesting to see if the New Deal for Business and the sorts of things the government are trying to do through the New Deal for Business are making any kind of inroads into that sentiment of businesses. Because in the end, the business environment and the sort of competitive and flourishing nature of it, quite a lot of it's about sentiment and businesses feeling that they are engaged and listened to by government, as well as, you know, just the sort of rules and regulations that are in place. So, yeah, so the Business Monitor is an important part of the work that we do every quarter at the FAI. And it's something, you know, given we've got that 25-year time series, it's a really rich source of data for us to understand what's happened in the economy.
Years of the Scottish Business Monitor. So, João, you joined us partway through the year.
I did.
So I was hoping that you could tell us a little bit about why you like us better than your previous job.
I hope my previous employers aren't listening. I hope maybe they are.
Apologies to Joao's previous employers.
Yeah, so as you said, Hannah, I joined midway through the year. I used to work at the Office for Budget and Responsibility. And yeah, it's quite different being a civil servant to working at the FAI. I'm quite enjoying it so far. And I think something that I've really enjoyed being part of the Institute so far is being able to kind of set some of the agenda of the things that we look at, rather than being as reactive as you have to be in a situation where, you know, you get commissioned to do something and you have to do it. And so that ability to be more proactive is really good and is really engaging. And that is, I think I've tried to do quite a bit of that, and I think we try to do it as well at the Institute. One of the things that I think has had quite a bit of impact in the public discourse that I worked on since I joined was the income tax estimates of how much the new band would raise. And this was part of a broader project that the Institute has invested in, which is to create a model for income tax that takes into account behavioral responses in the way that the Scottish Fiscal Commission does, or at least the way that we interpret their methodology as doing, based on documents in the public domain. And I think the main point of doing this is to kind of bring in some more clarity in the public debate about what exactly is a realistic amount of revenue that can be raised from income tax proposals. Because it's obviously much easier to just look at how much people earned a few years ago, operated by some numbers and based on forecasts, but also outturns since then, and just say, you know, you could raise this much. And that is true in a static sense, but people do respond to labour market incentives. And then the question is how and by how much and what can we say in a way that is going to be realistic. And also because the Scottish Fiscal Commission's forecasts determine the spending envelope. I mean, eventually there's a reconciliation about 2 or 3 years down the line, but essentially they are setting the envelope for the coming year. So it's really important to have a better picture of what that looks like. And so we've done this kind of big investment in the Institute of building this model, and kind of publicizing the results and trying to make a broader point in the public debate about exactly what that means. You know, there's a lot of conversations about, you know, will people just move out of Scotland because their income tax is 1p higher. That's, you know, that's maybe like one person in 5 million does that. But it's the all the combined effects of loads of people making small decisions can have a really big impact. And in ways that people don't necessarily even realize that they are doing that. It's not necessarily like a conscious decision. It's just like you are faced with options, and your options are depending on your what you can earn and what your firms can offer you. And then that kind of filters down into, you know, things like how much revenue something brings in.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think we're recording this podcast on the morning of the budget, so we don't yet know what announcements there will be on the actual budget. But I think the discourse over the last couple of weeks and the sort of speculation on different potential tax proposals have showed the importance of us putting these numbers out into the public domain so that they can be talked about. So we've looked at what we think the gap is between, you know, the money that the finance secretary is likely to have available to her versus the spending plans that they would like to do, and we're able to put the sort of money they could raise from different income tax proposals in the context of the issues that they're probably dealing with, which I think has been helpful because it's allowed us to point out probably that the sorts of changes that are being discussed are unlikely to, you know, to solve the problem that she has before her. So I think that is really important, and it's been an important investment in the Institute, but also one that I think has added sort of hugely to the public discourse on this and allowed it to be more rooted in reality, which I think is helpful.
Okay, and before we finish up, I'm hoping that you guys can share something that you're looking forward to next year. So looking out for something that you think will be really interesting, anything like that.
So I wanted to touch on some of the research we're doing, which has nothing to do with budgets or anything like that. And it's the research that we're doing in the FEI as part of the Centre for Inclusive Trade Policy. So this is a centre which is funded by the ESRC, and that we're doing in partnership with Sussex and Nottingham and Cardiff and Queen's. So this centre spans the whole of the UK, with universities from every nation of the UK involved in it. And this has been set up in a response to Brexit, essentially, to ensure that we increase the capacity of trade analysis in the UK, to ensure that wherever possible, trade policy is being set on the basis of, you know, sound evidence, which is a reasonable thing to ask. At Strathclyde, we've been building on some research we've done over the last few years, really trying to understand the impact that trade can have, not just on the macro economy, which is standard modelling that's done, but also what that means for actual people. You know, so not just what sorts of industries might be affected by different sorts of trade deals, but how it impacts on different types of employees. Is it going to impact on people with different characteristics differently, maybe people in the different parts of the country, different parts of the UK? And at the heart of that is really understanding the data and understanding what the current flows are of goods and services around the UK and what the sort of supply chain impacts are of changing trading relationships. So that's what we're doing. We're really digging around in the micro data on trade to understand what impacts there could be of changing trading arrangements on companies in the UK and on also their supply chains. And wherever possible, trying to understand where in the UK those impacts may occur. Now, as anyone who has ever dealt with trade data knows, it's not easy necessarily to get access to trade data, mostly because a lot of it's collected by HMRC. So we've been using a data set that's provided through the Secure Research Service by the ONS, which links up lots of business data to this trade data. It's not easy to work with because there are a lot of restrictions on its use. But we're trying to use this fairly new data set in quite novel ways to gain insights about this. And we're hoping that some of this data will be sort of put out over the course of 2024 as part of this wider centre. So if anyone's interested in trade analysis and trade policy, it's worth checking out the Centre for Inclusive Trade Policy. We put out a lot of blogs on different issues. But yeah, our focus here at Strathclyde is really on both trying to build that data, but also some of our colleagues are doing a significant amount of modelling to try and understand the impacts on different parts of the UK as well. So yeah, a really interesting project to be involved in, and I think really important to build up the capacity and understanding of trade policy and its impacts on different people.
My thing to look out for next year is more on the macro side, as I part of my background is in macroeconomics, and I find it very interesting. And I think we are coming to a very tough point where in kind of the monetary cycle. And I think as someone who started university when the 2008 crash happened, I have only as an adult ever experienced very low interest rates. So all the discussions that in my working life have happened have been like, are we stuck at the zero lower bound? What can the central bank do? What does this mean going forward? Everyone thinking about how long term there might be, you know, a new normal where interest rates are permanently around zero, or we have a negative real interest rate, and what that means for governments and how they should finance themselves, and for households and for prices of assets and things like that. And all of a sudden, we've had a shock that has caused interest rates to move off the zero lower bound. It's like we're all rediscovering all these mechanisms that we thought were hidden away in dusty cupboards where people were doing research of what happened during the Great Moderation or what happened in the 1980s. How did you get rid of inflation and things like that? And I think we are partway through the tightening cycle as a whole. I don't think there's a prospect of interest rates going much higher in the absence of any particular shocks. But equally, there's a lot of talk about like where will rates settle. That has huge impacts for things like return on investment on capital, what firms might be able to borrow at, what returns shareholders might demand, and that has implications for like what kind of prices they set, what kind of wage increases there will be. And so because we don't know, like the difference between them settling at the 5% sort of level that they are at now, or 4% or 3%, is huge. And it could herald very different futures for us and what people invest in and don't invest in, and how much assets are worth, house prices might change because of that. And the other thing is, you know, there's a lot of people who own their homes outright because they had mortgages a while ago and they've paid them off, and they've kind of been shielded from a lot of the increases in the cost of housing. There's a lot of people on the in the rental market who have been hit already by this increase in housing costs, and then there's like the slow moving renewal of mortgages in the UK as a whole, Scotland as well. There's a very short term fixing system where like people tend to fix their rates for 2 to 5 years and then go into variable rates and then go to new products. That means that you have like this slow moving snowball effect of mortgage rate renewals kind of taking effect. And there's millions of people, as the Bank of England said, that haven't yet felt this increase, but they will do for years to come. And the how that plays out and how quickly tightening or loosening happens might determine whether these people get hit with very large increases in their monthly cost of housing for a long time. And so that's something that's going to play out over the next 12 months, and that I am very interested in, because I think we need to think about, you know, what are the all the different ways that monetary policy feeds into the economy because there are things that might impact different people that we haven't thought about for ages because they haven't been a problem.
That's a really interesting point. I mean, it's felt like a long time in the economy since we're at some sort of equilibrium with everything that's happened over the last 5 to 7 years. And you're also portraying your age there when you're talking about not knowing, only remembering this sort of near zero interest rate environment. Can't say I'm the same. But finding that equilibrium and what it means for wider linkages in the economy to things like just wider productivity and things around the return on investment. And when we're in the period now of sort of things like full expensing being made permanent, you know, we're just going to transition to a different equilibrium in the economy. And it'll be really interesting to see what happens over the next 12 months on that, definitely.
So it's been a very interesting year. It's been a hard year for a lot of people. And there's certainly a lot of things to look out for over the next 12 months. So thank you, Mary and Joao, for joining me today. We are off after this until the new year, so that should give everyone plenty of time to catch up on our budget response and our publications from 2023 on our website, FraserVallander.org. So we'll see you back in January. Thank you for joining us. Until our next Fraser Vallander podcast, we'll see you then.